From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we begin a four-day series on the epidemic of violence that has taken the lives of many young people in America's inner cities. We'll hear from Rochelle and Anthony Yates. They became community activists after their five-year-old son Marcus was killed in 1988. It was a shooting that shocked the city of Philadelphia. Marcus was caught in the crossfire between two rival drug dealers in a convenience store. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD box set of Duke Ellington's recordings from 1953 to 55. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Bosnian Health Ministry now reports 35 people are dead from the shells that blasted into a Sarajevo marketplace today. 86 other people are hurt. The Bosnian Prime Minister expects the death toll to rise. Five shells crashed into the downtown area today, but it was one that caused much of the death. Most of the victims are children, women, and elderly people, many of whom lost limbs. It's not clear who fired the shells, but the Bosnian government says the Bosnian Serbs did it. The Serbs are denying the attack. They say the Bosnian government hit its own people to derail a new peace plan. At least eight deaths are being blamed on heavy rains from the remnants of Tropical Storm Jerry. The storm moved through North and South Carolina this weekend, causing streams and rivers to crest. It closed roads and forced some people to leave their homes. Eileen LeBlanc, a member station WHQR, reports from Wilmington.
Flash flood watches are in effect in 12 South Carolina counties and for the entire northeast section of North Carolina. Showers and thunderstorms are expected throughout the day as what's left of Jerry moves eastward back toward the Atlantic. It's been a rainy weekend in the Carolinas. The rain was at first a welcome relief from the hot, parched August. But as the ground became saturated with downpours and up to 11 inches of rain, flash flood watches were out in 71 counties across the two states. A dam at Rainbow Lake began leaking yesterday, and crews have punched pipes through the dam to ease the threat of a break. 80 families have been evacuated. The Neuse River is expected to rise a foot above flood level today. Forecasters are concerned about Jerry's possible redevelopment once he's back over the warm Gulf Stream waters. For National Public Radio, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Wilmington, North Carolina.
The governor of Arkansas, Jim Guy Tucker, has pleaded not guilty to the latest round of indictments in the Whitewater case. UPI's Michael Hiblin reports from Little Rock.
Governor Tucker faces an October trial date after pleading not guilty to an 11-count indictment. After his arraignment, Tucker told reporters that he won't give in to pressure from the independent counsel to plead guilty.
They're not going to make me knuckle under by filing indictments, by leaking information in an attempt to prejudice the jury panel, or by threats. It's not going to happen.
Two other people charged in this indictment, James McDougal and his ex-wife Susan, will be arraigned later this week. Michael Hiblin, Little Rock, Arkansas.
California Governor Pete Wilson is officially in the presidential race. He made his formal announcement today in New York with the Statue of Liberty as a backdrop. Wilson used the famous statue to underscore his theme that there's a, quote, right way and a wrong way to get into America. Wilson's been getting tough recently on illegal immigration. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is off 13 points at 4,588 in moderate trading. This is NPR. More than 100 people captured by Iraq during its occupation of Kuwait are reportedly being held in a prison near Baghdad. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
A Kuwaiti newspaper says that 145 Kuwaitis who disappeared during the Iraqi occupation are being detained at the Ridwania prison outside Baghdad. The English-language newspaper, The Arab Times, quoted sources in Amman, saying that the Kuwaitis are being held as part of an initiative by Saddam Hussein to break a stalemate over United Nations economic sanctions imposed on Iraq. The Kuwaiti government has consistently demanded the release of 605 prisoners it says were taken by Iraq before its forces were expelled from Kuwait in February 1991. Iraq says it is holding 116 people it captured from Kuwait 5 years ago. A meeting between Kuwaiti and Iraqi representatives is scheduled this week at their common border to discuss this issue. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
There's some kind of internal dispute going on at the Oklahoma Federal Prison, where the two Oklahoma City bombing suspects are being held. The Muskogee Daily Phoenix newspaper is quoting a lawyer for the prison's number three official, who says syringes were found on food trays sent to bombing suspects Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. The lawyer says the number three official, Charles Mildner, has been suspended without pay. Mildner's attorney says superiors revoked Mildner's order about who would handle food trays. The prison warden says the bombing suspects are not in jeopardy. Meanwhile, lower-level prison workers are expressing support for Mildner today. They're planning a rally and will picket the prison tomorrow. A published report says the search for the Unabomber has spread to Chicago. The Chicago Tribune is reporting the FBI is contacting teachers who may have had the elusive terrorist as a high school student in the 70s. Three of the earliest bombs were in the Chicago area. The paper says dozens of teachers are being questioned. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Guns and drugs have turned many American neighborhoods into war zones. Today we begin a four-part series on the epidemic of violence that has claimed the lives of many young people in our cities. My guests, Anthony and Rochelle Yates, lost their five-year-old son, Marcus, in the crossfire of a drug shootout in a Philadelphia candy store back in 1988. Their middle son and their nephew were wounded in the same shootout. The Yates have become community activists, working to keep drug dealers out of neighborhoods and to stop the violence. They speak at schools and community groups. Anthony Yates works in the Philadelphia Sheriff's Office. Rochelle Yates has turned their house into a daycare center and home for foster children. Last April, I asked Anthony Yates to describe what happened the day his son was killed.
July 18th, 1988, and my wife and I both were at work. So before going to work, we left the children with their grandmother on 59th in Springfield. And there's all of their cousins and some, you know, our nieces and nephews. So I think there was a total of, 11 family members that were with their grandmother. They all decided that to go to a candy store which is on the corner of 60th in Springfield, where they have a lot of video games and a lot of penny candy. And all the kids got together and went down there. While they were there playing the games and being as children are, you know, trying to buy this and buy that for the little bit of pennies they had, two Jamaican drug dealers decided that they have an argument in the store about who's taking over the corner as far as drug sales are concerned. In the interim, one of them left, went and got a gun and came back. Now, these two drug dealers, in the midst of all these children in between them, decided to have a shootout. One ran to the back, the other ran to the front. The kids were trapped in the middle, and they just fired. And I think there was a total of 14 rounds fired. One, unfortunately, you know, hit our baby, and he was killed instantly. The other one hit Malcolm twice.
Is he your older son?
Yes, my older son.
Your middle son.
Right, the middle son. And one hit our nephew, Micah. Hit him in the foot. Like I say, we were at work. So on the way home from work, I stopped and picked my wife up. And we come back to Springfield Avenue. There's a multitude of police, emergency wagons. And I inadvertently made a statement to my wife, the situation's getting crazy out here. This has got to stop. And I'm guaranteeing they shot somebody's child, not knowing it was our kids. And when we got there, our kids were already in the hospital. They were already gone from the scene. The only ones there was our 11-year-old at the time, which is our oldest son, Tony. And needless to say, he was hysterical. He's trying to explain to us what happened. I'm trying to find out from a friend of mine what went on that apparently was just about an eyewitness to the situation, especially of them bringing the kids out. My mother-in-law, she was gone. She was at the hospital already. So we went to the hospital, and then we found out the status of our children. And needless to say, I don't even know what we thought that day. It was just numb. It was just a numbing, terrifying day. Yeah.
You had one son who was not hit at all by gunfire. Did he hide under a table or anything?
Yes. At that point, it's like a candy store of video games and arcade machines. And the older children, they hid on the floor. They laid flat on the floor. And by Masani Bainbin, he just turned 5. He didn't know. He was looking at the candy, trying to figure out what he's going to buy. And my older child was trying to tell him to drop down and come crawl over to him. But so much confusion going on, he didn't know what was going on. So he ran to him. And when he fell, when the bullet hit his temple of his head, he landed right exactly at my older child's foot. And my older son put his finger inside the wound of his head to try to stop the bleeding. I don't know where he got that type of knowledge of how to, stop the bleeding. But it was just something he did. He called himself saving his brother's life. And he held his finger over there for a while. But he said, Mom, the blood kept coming out. And so he just felt that he had to run out of the store, which he did. He ran between the gunmen and went to call the police. So he called the police. He was the first one to call the police.
Wow. What was the emotional impact on your two surviving sons, the son who was hit and the son who
traumatic,
escaped?
Traumatic. They changed completely. I have two totally different children in front of me at this point. They were fun, outgoing, loving, caring, and they became withdrawn. My older child became very hostile. My younger son is very introverted. He stays in his room. He doesn't come out. He more so like kind of hides behind me and his father. We go out, he's right there. He doesn't like to go anywhere without us. And he's almost 14 years old and he still feels this way. And it's not normal. They're not really living a normal childhood. They had to grow up fast. They act older. They talk older. They have no kind of happy-go-lucky attitude anymore. They're very cautious of people. And my younger one always looked around, over his shoulder, because he always said, Mom, I just feel like somebody's watching me or somebody's behind me. And at this day, he still says that when I take him out, he's always looking over his shoulder.
He's the one who was shot.
Yes.
Yes. And because of the situation, they were just stripped of their childhood. Like she says, they were just forced to grow up. I mean, they were forced to be very cautious of everyone. And even when he went to school, tried to return to school after going through therapy and different bereavement classes. And even when he returned to school here in Philadelphia, the kids would always say, let me see where you were shot at, And, kids are just brutally honest, Let me see, where the bullet wound was. So he really didn't want to go back to school. And like she said, the older one, Tony, he became very defiant. He came very much against the system. And, we had to get them a lot of help.
Came from a straight-A student to all Fs.
His grades deteriorated.
He was almost basically at the level where he failed. And he was an A-B student all his life. And then his grades dropped drastically.
And the thing about it that people do not understand is people feel as though there's a certain amount of time, then you're supposed to be over that.
Mm-hmm.
The grief is supposed to be gone. You're supposed to continue on life as usual. Such is not the case. That stays with you for the rest of your life. And you try to do what you can to continue on. But there's no, it's been 6 months or a year, you snap out of it now, it's time to continue on. It doesn't work like that.
So your two surviving sons went in totally opposite directions. One became withdrawn and afraid, and the other became defiant.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For the one that became defiant, did he become involved with violence himself?
No.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. We were very fortunate the fact that we were able to send him away to upstate Pennsylvania to school.
To a boarding school?
More or less, it's
military.
Military
boarding school.
Oh.
By myself being a Vietnam veteran, I was able to enroll them in a school for veterans' children. And they're both in junior ROTC now, and one's ready to graduate, and the other one's coming along very well. He's in the Honor Guard drill team, and he's playing the trombone, of all things.
Oh, great.
And they're getting better. They're getting much, much better.
When your older son became defiant, was that a rebellion against you both?
No
authority.
Against authority.
But not your authority?
Mm-mm.
No.
So against teachers, cops?
Teachers.
Anyone in an authoritary position. And he didn't trust any authority.
Now, what position did that put you in? I mean, you were really disillusioned yourselves. So did you tell him, did you understand his lack of respect? Did you try to just convince him that he had to be more respectful? What position
did
you take?
We definitely understood his lack of respect. We understood why he felt he couldn't trust adults anymore. And we tried to, like I said, we tried to get him help. We get him therapy and put him in type of, counseling classes mm-hmm. and things like that. And we also, he respected us at home, but... And he never had, too much to a point where he was totally disrespectful to adults. Mm-hmm. It's just that he...
He didn't trust him.
He didn't trust him. That's why I guess that's basically that he didn't trust him at all. And he stands away from him, and he's very cold. And they'll talk to him. He'll just look at you, why are you talking
very
to me?
No emotions,
no feelings whatsoever. And it took a while.
Now, did the discipline of the military school... help them right away, or did your older son become defiant of the authorities
and
military?
I think more or less our religious background and in a way that my wife and I brought him up, and more or less the fact that he had the opportunity to leave the city.
Mm-hmm.
The congestion and the confusion of the inner city, I think him being away was a release and an opportunity for him to see how others lived in other situations without all the violence and negativity of the city.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates, and their youngest son was shot and killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout back in 1988. The neighborhood you live in is different, or the neighborhood you were living in at the time in 1988 is a different neighborhood than the neighborhood that Rochelle, your mother, lived in.
Yes, it was.
Where the kids were. Was your neighborhood a safer neighborhood?
Yes, it was.
Did the children feel safer at your house?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. My mother's neighborhood, basically, a lot of things was happening in that neighborhood. The neighborhood was changing, mm-hmm. and different type of people were coming in the neighborhood, and a lot of people were leaving. And so it was almost always a problem there. It seemed like it was always a racial problem or maybe... economical problem. So it was different, definitely different. Because the house that they were raised in with us, it was my house when I was younger. I was also living there when I was a child. So the surroundings was very comfortable, very familiar. Everybody knew them,
But you didn't feel that felt safe enough?
No.
For them?
No.
Not after that situation. No. Because unfortunately, a week before that happened, a little boy, Ralph Brooks, was shot. He was paralyzed.
In your neighborhood?
No. In North Philadelphia.
South Philadelphia.
And unfortunately, he's in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And that made us both start paying closer attention to what's going on in the street. And then 6-7 days later, it was our children.
Well, not so much the neighborhood. It was the school where my son was going to school at. Mm-hmm. They had to walk past drug dealers.
Right.
They had to walk past all type of elements out there. And that bothered me. I can't see my son being a victim of a drug-related incident and have to walk by the same type of people to go to school. It was just really was messing with his head, and he really wasn't able to accept that. So he needed to go to a school that was not in the community.
And for some time, my sons, including myself, were in a period of denial. They didn't want to believe that their brother was killed and was gone. And even though my wife, my kids were getting therapy, I didn't want no part of it. I denied the fact that I may need help. And I tried to deal with it on my own. And it wasn't easy. It's a thing I would never want no one else to have to deal with, to have to go through. But I think one of the first things you do is you go into denial. You don't want to face up to the fact that my main thing was I'm a grown man. I've served 2 tours in Vietnam, 10 years in the Marine Corps. I'm raising a family. I should be able to protect my family. I come home and this happens and I lose one of my sons and almost lose the other. That made me deny a whole lot as a man in this country. And it really made me question, just what type of world are we living in?
And you're saying, too, that you felt guilty even though it wasn't your fault at all.
Oh, yeah, because
exactly.
Because my kids are supposed to be able to walk the street. They're supposed to be able to go anywhere they want to go. When I hear reporters say, it was an unfortunate situation, your son was just at the wrong place at the wrong time, I snap out at them. There's no such thing as the wrong place at the wrong time for a child. We are protectors of those children. And if we don't do it, then there's no tomorrow.
So was there a point where you decided you wanted help and you wanted counseling?
No.
No.
You never got it.
So how did you get through the experience? Was there a period where you felt like you were starting to understand things that you hadn't understood before about your own reaction?
I started coming to grips with it after a while, but I think, you know, I know the only help that I got was through my prayers and my belief in God, mm-hmm. and that he would take us through this. And that's what brought me through.
My guests are Anthony and Rochelle Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout in 1988. The Yates have since become community activists. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout. I'm thinking about how hard it must have been to decide whether to send your children to the military academy or not. I mean, their safety was more ensured by sending them away, but at the same time, you'd lost a son, and now you're going to send two of them far away.
And that's what really angered me. I think I was at that point where I was really angry at society. I said, I can't. They took my youngest son, my baby boy, and now they taking my other two boys because I can't take my other two sons because I can't trust them to live here among the other people in this society. So now I'm a long distance mother. I resent that very much. And every time they come home, I just cherish every precious minute I have with them. And it's very hard. It's very hard to have your children, you know, being a mom long distance. Because you don't get a chance to see them do the things that you want to see them do and grow and ask you all the questions. And so it's been a struggle. It's definitely been a struggle.
Did you ever feel like they misunderstood and they felt that you were pushing them away?
Well, at the point, I did. I did push them away.
I think they kind of felt that at first.
At first, for the first maybe the year, I pushed all my children away because I couldn't handle it. I just felt that I was a bad mother. I felt that I couldn't protect my one child, and I don't deserve any children. And so I was into this, like, denial, this guilt-ridden stage, and I just kind of blocked them out of my mind. I just walked around like I didn't have any kids. It was totally devastating. I was totally depressed.
Really rough.
And I know my kids felt it, but we all were grieving at different ways, and I just felt very guilty, and I just felt that they would be better off with somebody else.
What changed for you? Was it the counseling that helped you understand
your reaction? Well, the
counseling
helped me, and my church was behind me, and the prayers of people that pray for me, and it brought me through.
And one problem we have here is that even our city government and our state government, unfortunately, has no provisions for situations of that nature. When we went through that situation, there was no place to get help except for this one lady that started an organization of her own, a bereavement center, Dr. Wanda Jenkins, and she sought us.
Well, they had a special program, I think, for families of homicide victims.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
So she found you?
Yes, she heard about us. She contacted us.
You know.
And she contacted us at the right time because when she came to the house, all the men in my family were out looking for the guys who murdered my son. And they were all rallying there that day to look for those guys. And she came knocking on the door, and everybody was ready to leave. And she said, can you just take your coat off and let me talk to you for a while? And by her coming in there doing that, it might have saved another life.
So the men in your family were going out to hunt these guys down?
Yes, at all costs.
No doubt about it, no question.
Anthony, were you involved in that too?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Did you realize what you were doing?
Oh, yeah. I knew exactly what I was doing. And to me, it was the right thing to do. And if I would have ran into those individuals, then I'd be doing time now, without a doubt. So I don't have any question in my mind about that.
Was that in part like your military training kicking in, too, that you knew how to deal with this?
Maybe it was some. A lot of it was revenge.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was because of the fact that I couldn't understand how these two individuals could be so callous and so uncaring about human life. And it really kicked in when we had to go to trial. And to see those two individuals sitting side by side, laughing and joking with each other, like they were buddies, when a little while ago they tried to kill one another, and in the interim killed my son. That was hard to deal with.
Michelle, when you saw the men of your family getting ready to hunt the killers down, did you try to stop them, or were you...
No, I was...
You thought it was a good idea, too?
No, at the point, I was in so much pain. I didn't even realize what was going on. I knew they all got together to try to find the guys, but I was in such another world. It's just that I didn't even relate to it. It was just like, you do what you have to do, you know?
What did the woman from the grief counseling program say to you that changed your mind?
She had
a lot to say
because she went through the same thing, but with her mother. And what she said made a lot of sense. And it made me stop and think that I didn't want to throw my life away when I still had three other kids to raise. And, you know, it made me start understanding the senselessness of what I was getting ready to do, because it was involving some good people, and they were going to go with me no matter what. And she slowed us down, made us think.
You have a daughter who I believe was conceived the weekend that your son was shot.
Yeah, she was born right around that time.
Yes, she was, and it was a miracle because I didn't want any more kids.
That was a gift. It happened at the time when we were at our worst. And by her being born, that took some of the focus and let us understand that, you know, we still have to live and that, you know, life has to go on.
Yes, I was totally upset when I found out I was pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
I said, how could he do this to me? I said, God, how could you do this to me?
Because she didn't want any more children. She didn't want nothing else to do with any more children.
I just felt that I have no control of my life. I think I had no... Till this day, when my children walk out the door, I'm terrified, you know. Not as much as I used to be, but they have to call me. They have to... I have to know where they were every minute of the day. And by my son being a teenager, it was kind of difficult for him. But I said, well, you know how I am. You have to let me know when you get to from point A to point B. And if you're going to stop between A and B, call me, you know. I need to know where you are. I need to know. And he'd be waiting for the bus, and he'll call me. He'll stop at another bus stop. He'll call me, you know. So he got used to it, and he didn't complain about it anymore. But wherever he is, wherever they go, I needed to know. My middle child, he wouldn't go anywhere, so I didn't have to worry about him. But the older one did.
Does your daughter know about her brother who was killed?
Ironically, yes, she does.
That's
she gets strange. This depression sometime, and she says she misses her brother. I said, well, how do you miss a brother
never
you've
seen.
Never seen, you know? And she has these crying spells at night, and she comes down, and I said, what's the matter? She said, I miss my brother. And it's been so, she acts like him. She took,
same
everything is
spirit.
Identical to him, except she's a girl. And it's so kind of strange, it's scary sometimes. Same personality, the same wit. She's very witty, very smart child. And it scares us a lot of times. So
it's like he was reincarnated as a girl.
Huh, right.
It's really strange.
It's really amazing.
Really, I tell you, people always say, boy, she just like Marcus. And I said, yes, she is. That's the only thing, she got pigtails, you know?
Rochelle and Anthony Yates recorded last April. They live in Philadelphia, where Anthony Yates works in the sheriff's office, and Rochelle Yates runs a daycare center out of their home. Our interview continues in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Music.
coming up on Fresh Air, we continue our conversation with Anthony and Rochelle Yates. Their 5-year-old son was killed in the crossfire of a shootout. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a CD box set of Duke Ellington's Capitol Sessions from 1953 to 55.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A White House spokesman says it's hard to believe that anyone else except the Bosnian Serbs are responsible for today's attack on a crowded Sarajevo marketplace. At least 35 people are dead. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Press Secretary Mike McCurry says the White House condemns what he calls this very tragic attack on innocent civilians in Sarajevo.
The United Nations is urgently working now to assess responsibility for this attack. We have no reason to believe that that responsibility lies with any party but the Bosnian Serbs.
In addition, McCurry says the situation is being assessed to determine whether NATO airstrikes are warranted to protect UN-declared safe areas, including Sarajevo, and that such a plan would not require approval from Yusuke Akacsi, the UN envoy in Bosnia. NATO and UN commanders on the ground have promised a more aggressive response to attacks on designated safe zones. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
Hurricane forecasters have named a new storm. Tropical storm Karen has formed in the central Atlantic Ocean, about 1,200 miles west of the Cape Verde Islands. It's moving west-northwest with top winds at about 40 miles per hour. It is expected to get stronger. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Iris is moving farther from land. Forecasters expect Iris to continue moving north for the next day or two before possibly moving to the northeast. Iris's top winds are at 70 miles per hour. All tropical storm warnings and watches have been dropped for the Caribbean islands. California Governor Pete Wilson has formally kicked off his presidential campaign. He used the Statue of Liberty today as a backdrop as he pressed his theme of halting illegal immigration. Wilson was heckled by a small group of protesters as he denounced President Clinton's administration.
He can't balance our budget. He can't even secure our borders. And if we can't control our own borders, how on earth can we call ourselves a sovereign nation? Maybe that's why these folks are here. Because I am the Republican whom this Clinton White House fears the most.
Illegal immigration, along with attacks on affirmative action and career criminals, are pillars of Wilson's campaign. He's also trying to jumpstart a late entry into the presidential race. He spent much of the summer recuperating from throat surgery. Chemical Bank and Chase Manhattan Bank say they've agreed to a merger worth $10 billion. The combination will create the biggest banking company in the United States. The new firm will be known as Chase Manhattan. It will have $297 billion in assets and 25 million customers. 12,000 jobs will be lost. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow lost 7.5 points to close at 4,594. Advancing issues led declines by a slim margin in moderate trading. This is NPR. In Michigan, a takeover of a Native American tribal center is entering its second week. Members of the Keweenaw Bay community in the state's Upper Peninsula took over the headquarters following a dispute with tribal leadership. The protesters include small children and elders. Mark Wilcox of member station WGGL in Houghton, Michigan, reports.
Officials are encouraged by talks to end the week-long standoff between dissident members of the tribe and tribal leadership. The group of up to 50 remains barricaded in the facility protesting tribal voting eligibility. Police from 6 Michigan tribes were at the scene around the clock until ordered off by tribal officials Sunday. Congressman Bart Stupak and State Representative Paul Tasanovich spent the weekend at the center encouraging talks between the two sides. Although no new talks are scheduled, Tasanovich said he and Stupak feel that progress was made. Workers are currently conducting tribal business from a temporary headquarters in a tribal-owned bingo hall. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Wilcox in Houghton, Michigan.
The United Nations Refugee Agency is declaring failure in Zaire. Officials say they cannot get Rwandan refugees to go home voluntarily. That means Zaire is likely to resume forced repatriations. The head of the refugee program in Zaire is blaming extremists in refugee camps who are beating, intimidating, and even killing those refugees who want to go home. Zaire began forcibly removing Rwandan refugees from the year-old camps last week, but stopped at the request of the UN. Switzerland has approved the transfer to the Philippines of nearly half a billion dollars in Swiss bank accounts of the late Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. A Swiss spokesman says the decision would put the money into an escrow account in the Philippines, pending court action there. The decision can still be appealed in Switzerland. The move is a major step in the 10-year battle between the Philippine government and the Marcos family for control of that money. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of interviews on the epidemic of violence that has taken the lives of many young people in American cities. My guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in 1988. He was killed in a candy store in southwest Philadelphia, where he was caught in the crossfire of two feuding drug dealers. In the first part of our show, the Yates told us about the murder and how it affected the lives of their two older sons. After the murder, the men of the family were ready to take the law into their own hands and track down the killers. But they were talked out of it at the last minute and let the criminal justice system do its job. Let's talk about the trial a little bit and what that process was like for you. Anthony, I'm trying to think of what it was like for you to sit in the trial of the two men who were accused of murdering your son, considering that you were not too long before that hoping to go out and get them yourself.
Sure. The hardest thing about it was our judicial system. Our judicial system denied us to go into court the first day because of the fact that the defendants said that we were a threat to them. And so we were asked by the judge to be removed from the courtroom. We never seen these individuals, never had any words with them. Just on their say-so, our system decided that they would close the court to us after waiting 18 months to find out exactly what happened in that store because our kids wouldn't talk about it and we didn't try to talk to them about it.
What I read in the paper was that you both weren't allowed in the courtroom until your kids had already testified.
Yes, but I would not allow my son to... especially my youngest son who was 6, I would not allow him to be there without me because he was already terrified. He was already withdrawn.
Yeah, he was definitely.
And I just didn't feel like that he should have some type of support there for him. So my mother and a couple other people that were allowed in the courtroom, they came out and gave us like kind of account of what happened.
So your son did testify even though... you weren't.
Yes, because he did have people there that he knew, that he felt comfortable with.
Rochelle, what was it like for you to sit in the courtroom and look at the two men accused of shooting your son?
Oh, boy, I tell you, I was very angry. I was so angry and so outraged. They humiliated us. They humiliated my children.
In the courtroom?
In the courtroom. One of them was, matter of fact, I was in a courtroom because I remember seeing him. I was in with one son. I didn't go in with the other son, but I was in with my youngest son. And he was like telling him, I'm going to get you or something like that, really trying to intimidate him. And also they cussed at me, you know, the defendants cussed at me and my husband and rolled their eyes and made snide remarks and read the newspaper and went to sleep.
They just totally did not care. You know, it was no big thing to them. You know, and you know, it's just so hard to understand and to put into words how it is to sit in that courtroom and hear them describe exactly what killed our son and exactly how he died, and for them two to sit there and
no remorse,
you know,
not 1 ounce,
you know, very callous, you know, and like I say, when they were being transported back and forth from the cell room, you know, they would look over at us and say a few words. But there was no way I could get to them anyway. So we tried to just deal with it and let the court system handle it, which was the hardest thing I ever did in my life.
What, letting them do it instead of doing it yourself? Both of the men were found guilty of murder in the first degree, and then after that, one of them had their sentence changed. A judge said that there was no intent to murder on the part of one of them, so that his.
But that didn't happen. We went to Supreme Court, and it was overturned.
it was overturned. The overturning was overturned.
Yes.
So he was given first degree again.
Yes.
So both of the men are now serving life sentences.
Exactly. Natural life sentences, plus I think about 16 years for the assault on Malcolm. They're serving life for the death of Marcus, but then they're serving extra time for the assault on Malcolm after they finish a natural life sentence. So they'll never be out.
No, I think that the jury was asked to consider the death penalty. Would you have felt any better or any worse if one or two of the killers had gotten the death penalty?
To tell you the truth, at that time, I was hoping they did receive the death penalty.
You were hoping they would get
the
death penalty?
Yes, and I don't believe in it because I'm a born-again Christian. But it was so much that went inside me, and I see that they had no remorse, none whatsoever. I just felt that why waste, $45,000 a year to house a prisoner? Why waste that time? Why waste that money on the person who don't care a darn about our children? So at that time, yes, I did hope that they both got the death penalty.
And now?
No, I don't feel that way. I don't have no right to take a life. I don't believe that anybody have the right to take a life. What they did was wrong, but they will have to pay for that. They will pay for their action in the long run.
Anthony, what about you?
I don't know. I'm still dealing with that issue. I don't know. That issue is still going over and over in my mind and in my head, and I haven't come to no clear decision on that.
My guests are Anthony and Rochelle Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in the crossfire of a shootout in 1988. The Yates have since become community activists. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates. Their 5-year-old son was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout at a neighborhood candy store in 1988. At what point did both of you start to feel like you had to do something? Did you do something besides grieving, that you had to try to do something to help other children or to try to stop other acts of violence, to protect children?
Well, for me, I noticed, and every time I read the paper, every time I look at the TV, my heart just grieves, and I'm always in tears. My husband said, "What's the matter?" Another child got shot or killed or abused, and it was just to the point where it was consuming my life. And he knew that I had to do something, and I would go to the parents of people whose child has been shot, and I go talk to them. I go through the neighborhood and talk to them. I call them on the phone. I call the newspaper to see if I can get the address. I just had to be there to support that mother who lost that child. And it was just like an obsession with me. And I knew I had to help these children because nobody was looking out for them. Nobody cared about them. They had no rights. They can't vote, so they have no rights. And it was just that the Lord told me, well, you have to do something for these children who can't take care of themselves. And so I opened my home. I always have kids in my house, always, even before I had foster children or the daycare. I always have, I was like a surrogate mother, I guess, to all the teenagers in the neighborhood. So it was just a need that I needed to do this.
And Anthony, was there a turning point for you where you started to feel like you wanted to take some kind of action?
Yes. After seeing all the grief that my kids and especially my wife was going through, and then continuously, as I say, after this happened, it seems as though it brought everything to the forefront. It seems as though every time you pick up a paper, it was the same situation. And I just could no longer deal with that, you know. There had to be a difference, you know. So I felt as though I knew some individuals that felt the same way I did, and we got together, and we started making that difference.
So tell us each what you're doing now. Anthony, you mentioned that you try to keep the drug dealers off your street.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you feel?
Well, any opportunity. There's been plenty of opportunities where people still would like for us to talk to kids at different high schools.
So when you go to schools, you talk to
other children.
Teenagers. And try to talk the teenagers out of a violent life.
Yeah, it's surprising. after my wife and I finished with a discussion that we had with the children, and we asked any of the children if they would like to talk to us alone, they designated a room, and that room is packed with kids that has problems at home, drug problems and other problems at home, abuse problems, and they want help. These children want to be helped. You know, it's not like the mass media is painting this picture that they're a lost generation. That's not the case. These kids want help. It's just the help is not there.
What can you do for them at that point?
The most we can do is try to console them, try to point them in the right direction where there is some type of shelter or some type of safety net for them. The main thing is like everything else in the city and in the state government now, funding to do things for people.
For prevention, any more prevention measures.
That is definitely needed.
Michelle, you bought a larger house so that you could open up your doors and provide daycare for children and take in foster children.
Yes.
How big is your house now?
Well, we have a 6-bedroom house at this point, and now it's getting too small. So we really do need to move, and I would like to move in a nicer neighborhood that the kids can feel more comfortable. But at this time, we won't be able to do that, financially able to do that. But we do try to provide them a nice home and something more acceptable than where they're accustomed to coming from.
Much better atmosphere.
So,
how many foster children at a time do you usually have?
Well, usually I have 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
And do you choose who the children will be?
No, I just, whatever. They knock on the door and say, "Ms. Yates, I need your help." I said, "Ring them on." That doesn't make a difference to me.
So do the children usually show up with a lot of problems?
Oh, definitely.
What kind of problems?
Definitely. One little boy we had, he was definitely a drug-addicted baby. He had no motor skills. He had no movement. He just laid there just like lifeless. And he was 4 months old. And every time the social workers come over, they just can't believe the progress that he made. He left me when he left me in December. And he's running and he's into everything. And they just cannot believe, you know, that this boy came from what they've seen. And everybody come over to say, "Let me see this little boy, you know, let me see him, you know." And they'd be so surprised that that's a little love and a little attention. It works wonders.
So most of the foster children are very young.
I have some that's 8 years old, 11 years old. So no, not all young. But the one that I had the most problems with were the babies that were drug addicted. I had children who lived in a roach infested home where that never ate. Didn't even know what a bathtub, you know, what water was, a bath was, what a bath was. So when I put him in a bubble bath, he was scared because he didn't know what the bubbles were, you know. So it was really...
Some of them were in bad shape.
They were in bad shape. And they eat. And they stuff food in their mouth. And they keep it in there. And they sleep with it in their mouth because they think they won't get another meal. So it's kind of hard to try to let them understand that this food will be here for you. It's just really heartbreaking.
What's your neighborhood like now?
Mm-hmm. It's like any neighborhood in Philadelphia. I don't think there's any place you can go that it's not the same situations going on in the neighborhood. It's not as prevalent as other neighborhoods, but some problems do exist. You know, and we do what we can as neighbors on that block to try to, you know, alleviate those problems.
What can you do?
We can get out there and let the people know by show of force, letting those know that want to deal in those drugs, that want to deal in the activity of carrying weapons, that they're not going to do it on our block. That if they do, this is what they're going to suffer and this is who they're going to see.
So how do you get that message out?
By being there.
They go out there and talk to the guys. They make
a
move.
By being there, by stopping them as soon as we see them.
You stop drug dealers and talk with them. How do you stop them?
By just going up to them, let them know, look, I live in this neighborhood. You're not bringing this in my neighborhood. And whatever it is that you do, whatever it is you think you can do, the same thing is going to be done to yourself in this neighborhood. You won't bring it here.
Is that effective?
Oh, yeah. Because they understand you're not playing.
Well, do they ever?
You cannot be, you're not afraid.
They're probably the one who has the gun, though, not you. So do they try to intimidate you when you're talking to
them? I haven't been threatened or intimidated by any of them to my face. I've heard a lot of rumors, but I don't worry about that. You know. So, I'm a firm believer dealing with any problem head on.
Do you think that things are at the point in Philadelphia where people are getting numb to the number of homicides?
Or? Definitely.
Most definitely.
How do you see that? How can you
The reaction of children. Do you have a reaction of children? The children see or hear about another child being killed, and it's not devastating anymore. It's over with, you know. So-and-so ain't gotten shot. It's like no big thing.
Well, how can you get around the numbing?
I don't know. For some reason, it's been happening so often that it's like desensitized people.
Yeah.
You know, it's
I think
like,
they had to start caring again. I think people need to start caring about one another again.
About one another. You know, that's what's lost.
And people don't care about each other anymore.
You know, people walk down the street now, and if you speak, it's like you've done something wrong. You know, they're afraid of you. Mm-hmm. You know, when we grew up at a time when we hardly even locked doors, you know, at night. You stay on the porch all night with your friends, you know what I mean? You could walk anywhere in the city you wanted to walk. All that is gone. All those values have to be brought back. I know it's a cliche you hear time and time again, but it's very true.
Yeah.
It takes a whole village to raise one child, you know, just not the people in that area.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anthony and Rochelle Yates recorded last April. They live in Philadelphia, where Anthony Yates works in the sheriff's office and Rochelle Yates runs a daycare center out of their home. Our series on young people and violence continues tomorrow. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, on today's program, we'll hear about an artillery attack that hit Sarajevo, the Bosnian capital, causing many deaths. Also on today's program, we'll hear about police investigating the Chicago public schools, looking for clues about the identity of the Unabomber, who it's now thought might have some connection to those schools. Also on today's program, we will hear about this season of very active tropical storms. The director of the National Hurricane Center tells us that indeed we are on a record pace, challenging that of 1933. And also Governor Pete Wilson of California announces again for president.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The current CD reissue cycle has seen the release of many excellent Duke Ellington records and some long considered not so great. Mosaic Records has now issued a box set of Ellington's recordings on the Capitol label from 1953 to 55. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that to most Ellington fans, it's among the master's least impressive legacies. And yet...
tell from that version of Harlem Airshaft, but this band was in a slump. In the early 50s, Duke Ellington wasn't writing much, at least not for him. He was even commissioning charts from other arrangers. His star saxophone soloist, Johnny Hodges, had split to lead his own band for a while. That was tough. But Ellington did what he usually did when one of his signature voices left. He got someone else to play in the same style. Just different enough not to be a clone, but close enough to go for the same effect. The Hodges surrogate on a remake of 1927's Black and Tan Fantasy is probably Rick Henderson. Ellington spent a lot of time at Capitol redoing his old band hits for the new hi-fi market. But some of his best sides for the label were quickies for Trio that needed little or no prep time. That was Who Knows, 1953. The melody sounds like Ellington had been keeping up with Bud Powell's current bebop records. Duke's best pieces transcend their time. That's how he could revive tunes 30 years later. But he had a sweet tooth for fads. He cheerfully bit into rock and roll, cha-cha-cha, and the mambo, to name three. Isle of Capri was arranged for Ellington by Gerald Wilson, who still writes in that knockout vein for his own big band. In a way, Mosaic's 5-CD box of off-peak Ellington comes at the right time. In a cocktail music revival, Duke's dregs sound better than okay. The reason is simple. Texture. The rich Ellington sound was so familiar by the 50s, outside arrangers could write for it, and understudies could play key roles. Early on, they'd called Ellington's style jungle music, a dubious term for sure. But think of a jungle as voluptuous with colors and forms blooming and entwining everywhere. To compare Ellington's magic realism to the elevator music of Esquivel is like comparing Gabriel Garcia Marquez to a velvet painting. Duke at his worst is bad music at its best.
Kevin Whitehead writes about jazz for Pulse and Coda. He reviewed the complete Capitol recordings of Duke Ellington on Mosaic Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series on young people and the epidemic of violence. We'll hear from Jeffrey Canada, who runs a community center in Harlem. After growing up surrounded by violence, he now teaches young people how to avoid violence. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.